Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. 8:30, time to get started. I want to welcome everybody. Welcome back. Really, it's been a while. So Rabbi Eitan Avinair, who is a graduate of Yeshiva Gatzmicha at Yeshiva University, graduate in engineering, I think, from Machon Lev in Israel, studied for many years in Eretz Chem de Kolel in Israel, got another smicha, Rava Ir smicha, that's a higher level smicha in Israel, and has been teaching now. This is year three, if my calculations are right, here in Toronto as in the Bnei Akiva high school system for the girls and the boys at two different buildings. But anyway, so it's a pleasure. We're neighbors. I look forward to davening together with you in shul again, please God, in the not too distant future. And Rabbi Avinair, Vakasha.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back on Torah in Motion. I feel at home here that I can, you know, sit in my lounge chair and talk what I want to say with no boundaries. So let's, without further ado, let's start that. Okay. One of my favorite parts of teaching is that I get to make titles to my shiurim, and they can be whatever I want. That's really the fun of the game. So what's the halacha regarding halacha? If that title doesn't confuse you, or it does confuse you, hopefully it won't in a little bit. And I want to preface with a statement slash question. If I had to pick two individuals from the past 1,500 years of Jewish history, two rabbis who were the most influential in terms of the halachic process, the development of halacha, Rabbi Kalman, who would you pick? Well, let's. You're muted, Rabbi Kalman.
I tell other people to mute. I got to mute too. Okay, two most important rabbis. I would pick influential Rabbi Yehuda.
In terms of, okay.
I don't know what you're trying to say. I would pick, we should ask other people. Since you asked me, I would pick Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and the Rambam.
Okay,
you're going to tell me, of course, it's Rabbi Yosef Karo, I understand, but you're right on a practical sense, but I don't think you can have a discussion about any topic and anything in Judaism and the Rambam's not part of the conversation. Impossible.
Okay, wonderful. So I didn't pay Rabbi Kalman to say any of that, but that's perfect because those are three individuals I want to discuss tonight. I said two because I limited it to 1,500 years. If we go back, I would have included Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi as well.
That's right. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is 1,800 years. I'm sorry. I missed that part.
All good. I want to talk about Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi as well. I don't want to confuse anybody with the... So let's take a Rambam and the Shulchan. Rambam and Rabbi Yosef Karo. Rambam of the 12th century and Rabbi Yosef Karo of the 16th century. Now, we'll talk about their works and the type of impact they had and the legacies that they left. But what's less spoken about is the opposition to their works. And the truth is, I'll include Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi in this as well. We look at Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi as Hanasi, the great one, the great prince. But the truth of the matter is that there was much opposition, or not so much opposition, there was opposition to what his endeavor was in terms of writing the Mishnah as well. So that's a starter. So let's take a look. And actually, I want to preface with another question. It starts off with the Gemara in Gittin, kind of a distinction between Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, and Torah Shebaal Peh. So the Gemara in Gittin expounds and tells us how we know, says as the following. Let's say in the middle, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish says, Rabbi Yehuda bar Nachmani expounds and he says, Ktuv locha et hadvar ma'ela, it says in Parshat Ketisa, that you should go ahead and you should write these things. That's one pasuk. And another pasuk, right next to it, same pasuk says, Ki al pi advar ma'ela, on according to these things, you should do them. So one implies you should write it, and one implies you should keep it oral. That's what the Gemara assumes. And the Gemara says, Haketzad, how could it be? The Gemara answers, Dvar mishbechtav iyata rashai lo omran al peh, Dvar mishbal peh iyata rashai lo omran bechtav. So the written Torah, the Torah Shebichtav, that which we have, the Tanakh, the Torah, the Nevi'im Mektuvim, that has to remain written. It cannot be taught orally. And the oral Torah cannot be written, cannot be taught from writing. And that's how it was for many years. Now, if I would ask, what do we refer to as the oral Torah nowadays? the Mishnah, the Gemara, other books of that nature. And the obvious question is, well, what happens? Or isn't it supposed to be oral? How all of a sudden did it become written? So the Rambam in his Hakdama to the Mishnah Torah lays out a little bit in terms of the history of how he saw things. So he brings, at the beginning, talks about how, we'll read it in here. The mitzvah, interesting that he calls it the mitzvah, the explanation of the Torah, referring to the oral Torah. He did not transcribe. Instead, he commanded it verbally to the elders, to Yeshua, and to the totality of Israel. As it states, be careful to observe everything that I prescribe to you. For this reason, it is called the oral law. Even though the oral law was not transcribed, Moses, our teacher, taught it in its entirety to the courts, to the 70 elders, Elazar, Pinchas, and Yeshua, received the tradition from Moses. So the oral law was given at Har Sinai, and Moshe Rabbeinu passed it down as well. Okay. Now, he goes through the history and he says there are lots of persecutions, and eventually Rabbeinu HaKadosh chiber HaMishnah. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi went ahead and he wrote the Mishnah. Why? What happened? From the days of Moshe, our teacher, until Rabbeinu HaKadosh, no one composed a text for the purpose of teaching the oral law in public. Instead, in each generation, the head of the courts or the prophets of that generation would take notes of the teachings which he received from his masters for himself and teach them verbally in public. It's very interesting. Rambam there's actually a machloket Rishonim about the prohibition of writing oral law. There are some Rishonim who say that you're not allowed to write it at all. But the Rambam was of the opinion that you were allowed to write it. You were allowed to take your own personal notes, but to go ahead and teach it from writing, that was the prohibition. So the Rambam says in every generation, people would do this and they would have their own notes, but they would teach it orally. Similarly, according to his own potential, each individual would write notes for himself of what he heard regarding the explanation of the Torah, its laws and its new concepts that were deduced in each generation concerning the laws that were not communicated by oral tradition, but rather deduced using one of the 13 principles of biblical exegesis and accepted by the high courts. So another interesting point here is that the Rambam says that oral law, there was what was given at Har Sinai, but the oral law actually was something that evolved and developed over time. Namely, there were halachot, there were situations in which there was no specific law given, and the rabbis had to deduce, had to extract from the Torah itself, using the Yud Gimel Midrash HaTorah Nidrashat Behem, what to do in these specific cases. Interesting whether those laws have a rabbinic status or a biblical status. That's more of a for another time. But in any case, the Rambam sees oral law as something which evolved and developed over time. But nonetheless, it stayed oral until Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Now, what happened? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in the 3rd century. And the Rambam writes like this. This situation continued until the age of Rabbeinu HaKadosh. He collected all the teachings, all the laws, and all the explanations and commentaries that were heard from Moses, our teacher, and which were taught by the courts in each generation concerning the entire Torah. From all these, he composed the text of the Mishnah. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi went around and he collected basically the writings of all the other Tanaim. He compiled it into 6 volumes. Ordered it according to Masechtot, and that became the Mishnah. And this was the first time in history that there was actually a book which was to be a compilation of the entire oral law. And he taught it to the sages in public and revealed to it to the Jewish people, who all wrote it down. They spread it in all the places so the oral law would not be forgotten by the Jewish people. Amazing. Now, why did Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi do this? Is there not a prohibition against writing down the oral law? So the Rambam explains, why did Rabbeinu HaKadosh do such a thing? Instead of perpetuating the status quo, i.e. the prohibition of writing down the oral law, because he saw the students becoming fewer, new difficulties constantly arising, the Roman Empire spreading itself throughout the world and becoming more powerful, and the Jewish people wandering and becoming dispersed to far ends of the world. Therefore, he composed a single text that would be available to everyone, so that it could be studied quickly and would not be forgotten. Throughout his entire life, he and his courts taught the Mishnah to the masses. Amazing idea. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi comes along and he says, listen, if we don't start writing this down and have some type of unified text, everyone's in persecution, the Jewish communities are spreading out. We have to bring everything together. We have to have a text. We have to write it down. And in the eyes of the Rambam, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, saved Judaism in that sense. Write down. What a great idea. Now, I don't want to be heretical here, but if it's such a good idea, then why didn't God do that? Meaning, why was there a prohibition to write it down in the first place? It seems like Rabbi Yehuda has a good point. Just write it down so you don't forget anything. I mean, don't we all do that? Why is there an oral law at all? I'm okay with opening this up. If anybody has a suggestion, because I think the question is better than any answer we can give at this point in this year. People had better memories back then. Okay, it could be that it was easier for them to memorize it. But let's say you have a bad memory like me. Why is it prohibited to write it down? To have notes when you're teaching it? So I've heard different answers, and none of them really suffice for me, right? Some people say, well, if you have to memorize it and you're not allowed to write it down, so then it becomes more ingrained in you, right? Like I was talking to some students, and I was able, it was amazing, I was able to recall the phone number of my best friend from childhood. I was able to just pull it out of my memory without thinking. I hadn't thought about this number in probably 25 years. And I was able to bring it out of my memory. I don't even know my wife's phone number nowadays because it's on my phone, right? But because I was forced in growing up in a time before cell phones, you're forced to memorize certain things, so it becomes part of you, which is a valid point. But the problem with that answer is that if you look at how now that we have the oral Torah written down, we have the Mishnah, we have the Gemara, we have everything which came after it, I don't think it's any less part of us. I mean, there are great Rosh Yeshiva who Yomam Valayla, they're Oseik in that. It's who they are, it's their identity. And furthermore, those who are very much into learning the Tanakh, the Chumash and Nevi'im and Ketuvim, so is it not part of them because it's written down? So that answer is I find a little shaky. I find a little shaky.
Rabbi, I don't know if do you see the answers in the chat box? In the chat box, just
okay.
Take a look.
So okay, good. Oh, a lot of here. Okay, let's see. So printing publishing was uncommon. It would turn the Torah over only to the elite. And the truth is, you can even take that argument and say, well, if you keep it oral, then look what you're going to do. Only those people who had great memory, who can go ahead and categorize it in their heads and keep it like that, they're going to be the ones that are, so to speak, the owners of it. To engage in debate, is that a good thing? Do we want to engage in debate? In fact, as we'll see, the Rambam views machloket as something that's very negative, right? That it was a historical accident. Halavai that we never had machloket. We should just erase all of machloket. In fact, the Rambam is going to do that in our very next line. Less flexible. Frozen. Okay, so some of these ideas we're going to talk about. That question of why the oral Torah was to remain oral, I want to come back to at the end. In any case, the Rambam goes on, it's not written here, but he goes on and he explains everything that happened since Rabbeinu HaKadosh wrote down the Mishnah, how then we had the Gemara, and the Gemara went ahead and around 500, and it expanded on everything from 200 to 500, it expanded on everything that was in the Mishnah, explaining it, finding contradictions between different Tanaic sources, and then the Savarim and the Gaonim go on and expand on that, and kind of everything is just building on and evolving. So the Rambam saw it that this became crazy, there was just too much going on. How is anybody supposed to know what to do? So therefore, he wrote the Mishnah Torah. In the Mishnah Torah, I don't think I'm over-exaggerating if I say that it's probably, the greatest, most impressive work that any Jewish scholar has written in the past, you know, since Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, maybe even more. I don't know, that I can already, we can argue about. If we think about it, the Rambam wrote that he started writing in his 30s. It took a whole 10 years. And he basically, without the help of, you know, Bar Ilan and a word processor, he was able to go ahead and take all of the Torah, all of the biblical laws, all of the rabbinic laws, and he was able to reorganize it, categorize it. Because in the Gemara, it's just a big mess. You don't know left and right. You're on one dot here, and they have to jump another way to find the continuation. You're not really sure what's going on. And he categorizes it in 14 books in a masterful way. I just think about, how did one man do that? How did a person do that in the 12th century? It's beyond. It's truly beyond that he was able to do such a thing. And he wasn't so modest about his what he was able to do. He writes here, "Lefichach karati shema chibur zeh mishne Torah." He calls this literally the second to the Torah. Why? Lefisha adam koreh baTorah. You go ahead and you finish your Shnai Mikra. You read all of the Tanakh, and you say, "Well, now what should I learn?" So he reads all the Torah tchila. Ve'achakach koreh bezeh. He's going to go ahead and he's going to read the Mishne Torah, the second to the Torah. Ve'yodemi menu Torah shabal peh kula. He knows all of oral law. Ve'enot zerich lekrot sefer acher b'neim. You don't need anything. That means, think about how much money you'll save on bookshelves. You don't have to go to IKEA and buy more bookshelves. You just have a Tanakh. You can even invest since you're now you have saving all this money on other books. You just have a really, really nice Tanakh and a Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah without all the commentaries on the side. Just Mishneh Torah. You can get it in one volume. That's all you need, right? And in other words, the Rambam basically dissolved the Talmud. We no longer need it. And we no longer need the Mishnah. We just have one book which tells me all of halacha. Now, the Rambam did something which later in his life, much, much later in his life, he regretted. But it's interesting to understand why he did it. He wrote the Mishnah Torah without any sourcing. There's no footnotes. There's no, I'm telling you who says this what. There's no dissent of opinion. There's no machloket. This is what it is. This is the halacha. Dry on the page. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Later on, he regretted it because he couldn't find his sources, which he thought that he would always remember, and that's interesting. But so that's the Mishnah Torah. The Rambam goes ahead and he writes the Mishnah Torah. Now we look at it, 900 years later, and we say, "Wow, that's an amazing thing. It's like the best thing that could ever happen to Judaism." And the Rambam wanted it to be this way, that people could just open it up and look, and here's the halacha. The Rambam, I know this is a controversial topic, but I think it's clear in the Rambam writes a letter to a certain Rav Yosef, where he talks about his understanding of what the purpose of Gemara is, and where people got it wrong. And the Rambam writes as such, and this is in one of his letters, in the Igrot, the goal of the learner filling the time with give and take of the Talmud, right, the shock of Atari, the back and forth, all of the debate, all the dialogue, as if the intention of the goal was to practice and the perfection of argument, and nothing more than this. Like, why should we sit and learn Gemara? Because it helps us become better lawyers, right? Like, it helps us develop mental capabilities, skills. Like the Koreans, they go ahead and they learn. You learn Talmud, or you want to be a good lawyer, so you can go ahead and you can open up a Baba Kama, and it's going to teach you argument and logic. But says the Rambam, no, this wasn't the original intent. The give and take, as well as machloket, developed by chance, an unfortunate reality. But when the issue was in stalemate, whereby each man stood behind his interpretation, he wouldn't give. It was incumbent upon each to show their proofs and defend their opinion. Oh, missing the rest of the letter. The rest of the letter, Rambam writes, I apologize, it's not here. The Rambam says that it's not about the dialogue back and forth. Okay, that's not what it's about. It's about, in the end of the day, we need to find the bottom line halacha. I really apologize that it's not here. You need to get the bottom line halacha. At the end of, Daf Chav Vav in the Gemara, it tells you what the bottom line, halacha takir, what's the halacha? That's what it is. And we need to get back to that, to learn Gemara for the sake of getting to the bottom line halacha. And therefore, it's no wonder the Rambam goes ahead and he says, why do I need all this machloket? Why do I got to talk about Beit Shammai all the time when Beit Shammai isn't halacha? Let me go ahead and dissolve the Gemara and make a Mishneh Torah. And that's exactly what the Rambam did. Who could have any complaints about such an endeavor? It's amazing. Now, the irony is on the Rambam, because he wanted only two books, the Torah and the Mishneh Torah. And the irony is that out of probably any book after the Talmud, the Rambam's Mishneh Torah has caused more books to be written. meaning more books have been written on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah than any other book post-Talmud in Jewish history. So that is, I guess history has the last laugh on the Rambam. Okay, that was in the 12th century. Comes the 16th century, and Rav Yosef Karo, now in Eretz Yisrael in Tzfat, he has a similar, not exactly the same, he has a similar initiative. Now, Rav Yosef Karo saw, and he's the start of basically the Achronim period, very much because of this work. Oh, someone quoted this. Yes, I saw Rav Schechter's his comments.
Later, I put it in. We can discuss it at the end of the show.
Yeah, and I don't want to get into that because I don't want to go too political. But right. Yes.
That was quite a piece. Quite a piece.
Okay, we'll stay away from that for now. Now, so Rav Yosef Karo lived, so now we have 300 years later, and a lot has happened. Right, the Rambam's idea of now having one book which everyone's happy with didn't really work out that way. All of the other Rishonim start to write their books, and they're starting to argue on the Rambam, and you have lots of different opinions. And so Rav Yosef Karo writes here that the evolution of history, lo nasit haTorah kishtei Torot, we don't now have two Torot, but rather, ela ketorot ein mispar. Mispar rov hasfarim nemsem bebir mishpatim v'dineya. We have endless books. Every Joe you know is writing some type of perush on the Talmud or some type of book of halacha. And what are you supposed to do? Demimor adam b'chol din sheitzdarech lachkor sharasho motzo d'vrei ha-gemara mefarshim. Let's say you have a shayla, right? Pesach's coming up. You're preparing a soup. It's Erev Pesach, and you're preparing a chicken soup for the Seder. And you know your daughter is helping you, stirring the pot, and you're like, oh my God, where'd you get that ladle? What do you mean? I took it from the drawer. Oh my God, which drawer? And they took it from the chametz drawer. And now you have a shayla. What do you do? Is this after the shayla? A whole big shayla on what to do with Isra Heter. So now, what are you guys supposed to do? So the Rambam says, what are you going to do now? You're going to start to open up all the Gemaras. You even know what Gemara to open it up. You're gonna have to find, right? You have to find where the Gemara is, Meforshim, the Poskim, Kulam Yechabeda, Davar Alav Ma'od. There's just so much to do. Kol Shekin Yalem and Sam Petach Ladat Malkom Adin B'Talmud. Do you even know where to open up in the Gemara? It's Erev Pesach. You have time to do all this now? It goes on. V'Gam Ki Adem Malkom Adin B'Gemara Yitzarech La'En Ki Asugya Ahi. And even if you know where it is in the Gemara, you know where it is in Pesachim, and you know it happens to be that there is a parallel sugya in Avodah Zarah, so you can open it up. So now, what are you going to do? You can open up with Rashi and Perush Rashi, then you can open up with Tosfot, and then V'achakachayim V'divei Riff. You got to open up the Riff. You got Rush. You got to open up the Rush. How you do without the Rush and the Ron and the Mordechi? V'achakalayim V'arambam. All the Rishonim. V'ashar Poskim. V'gam Divrei Tshuva Tegdolam. All of the Shutim. All of the responses that were written afterwards. All of this to see who's arguing with who, which one is the majority opinion, which one is accepted, and what's going to happen. There's no end to it. By the time you get to the end of the child, you're like, aha, I know what to do with the spoon. Your wife's like, honey, it's Shavuot. Like, forget about the soup. We're done with this. It's just the enterprise of halacha cannot function that way. And the Im Yomer Adam Levchor B'Sifrei Kotzrim, HaKotzrim, we can go ahead and we can pick a summary book. The Smak Igor HaKobo. It might be a shorter way, but it's really the longer way in the end. Because you're not going to learn anything from these books. These so shorthand, such summaries, they're useless. So therefore, explains Rav Yosef Karo what his intent here is in writing the Beit Yosef. This is the introduction to the Beit Yosef. Very important. Al Kein Ani. Hiskamti lechaber sefer kolel kol hadinim hanogim bebir shorsheim umotzeim ba'magamara im kol chilukei svarot haposkim ish lo nedar. So he waits. Rav Yosef Karo comes along. He says, "I want to write a book that's going to give it. It's going to give you everything. It's going to give you the source of the Gemara. It's going to give you a tamsit. It's going to give you a summary of what the Rishonim say. The main opinions in the Rishonim organized." Nothing's going to be missing from this. I'm not going to go ahead and I'm going to write a separate, independent book on this. Why should I go ahead and and just, you know, start from scratch. Why I have to reinvent the wheel? People have already written books. Right? I don't have to go ahead and redo what somebody who already came before me did. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to attach my book, the Beit Yosef, to a pre-existing book. It'll be an add-on. At first, this is actually very interesting. At first, he's like, you know what? Do it on the Rambam. Any greater safer that I can do? And then on the Rambam, is the greatest. Let me go ahead and write it on the Mishnah Torah. The Chazar TV, but I reneged. I decided not to do it on the Rambam. Mipnei she'enu mavi ela svara achat, v'hayiti tzarich la'arich v'lechtov svarot shara poskim v'tamam. Because the Rambam just wrote his opinion. That's it. And if I want to go ahead and I really want to get to the bottom line what the halacha should be, I would have to go ahead and start, in a sense, from scratch in all of the other opinions. So it's not so practical. V'lachin iskamti l'smoch l'sefer arbaturim shachaber harav Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Harosh. Rabbi Yosef Karo decides to go ahead and to write the Beit Yosef as a commentary to the arbaturim by Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher of the 13th/14th century. Now, I don't think the tour gets enough credit for what he did. I mean, he really... The order that we have of the Shulchan Aruch, it's really the tours. He's the one who organized that the way that he did, and he really wrote the first encyclopedic, kind of index on halacha the way he did. The thing is, though, that he brings lots of different Rishonim, and he's not really conclusive in the end, and doesn't necessarily bring the source of where it is in the Gemara. So it's an amazing sefer, but incomplete, and definitely doesn't reach the status of what the Beit Yosef is going to do with it. Okay, so you can have, just for those who aren't familiar, you can have a piece in the tour, you know, which could be five lines, and then the Beit Yosef comes along, and he tells you, so this is the Gemara number one that this comes from, and this is Gemara number two, and this is what Rashi says. And this is what the Ran says, and this is what the Rambam says, and this is how you deal with that steer, and this is what the Tosfos say. He'll go through the entire sugya. It is an amazing, amazing resource. But after you explain it all, what are you going to do with the bottom line halacha? And this is what Rabbi Yosef Karo decides to do. V'ale medati she'achar kol advarim, after I explain everything, efsok halacha v'achriya ben asfarot, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to give you one bottom line. Kizeu hatachlit. Because at the end of the day, what do we want? We want one law, one Torah. If we go ahead and we say, okay, well, let's see what the Ran says, and let's see what the Ramban says, and we'll start asking kashas and difficulties and all of these, we'll have dionim on what the Rishonim say. So we're not going to get anywhere. What you think the Ramban didn't think about your question? You don't think you had an answer? How are you going to go ahead and compete with the Ramban? You got a machloket between the Ramban and the Rashba. Who are you to go ahead and put your head between two mountains? You're going to go ahead and say who's right? Rabbi Yosef Karo says, well, we'll have none of that. That's not how we're going to do it. V'lechein, hiskamti b'da'ati, therefore I decided what I'm going to do. Liot shaloshet amudei ha'ara'a asher... I'm going to use the three big pillars of Horah, of Psak, of Halacha. And who are they? The Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. It's like a draft. The Rambam picks his first three rounders. The Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. And we're going to go by Rov. This is my Beit Din. If two of them agree on something, end of the discussion. If three of them agree, all the better. It's not so fair. Why is that not so fair, what the Rambam does here? Not fair. Lo yafeh. The Rambam and the Rif are both Sfaradim. And the Rambam comes from the same Beit Midrash as the Rif, more or less. So the Rambam, you know, 95% of the time is posking like the Rif in any case. So when you say I'm going to use the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush, it's a joke. You're basically saying I'm posking like the Rambam, which is more or less what the Shulchan Aruch does. Okay, no. And the Rush is supposed to be like our token Ashkenazi. But it's also...
He was just way ahead of Pesach.
Sorry?
He spent half his life in Spain.
Right, exactly. He's our token Ashkenazi who's not really Ashkenazi. He ended up moving to Spain and getting an internship with under the Rashba. So he's not, if he went back to Ashkenazi, he'd be like, you're not one of us. What are you talking about? In any case, that's what he decides to do for better or worse. Nimsa Sefer Zeh Mazon Lekulei Bar. It is my, this book, this Beit Yosef, is going to be bread and butter for anybody who wants it. Al Ken Karativ Beit Yosef. Therefore, he calls it the Beit Yosef. Ki Kishem Shemi Beit Yosef. Aye Yosef Atzadi Hayunizim Akol Mazon Haguf. Because Yosef, his Beit Yosef, his storehouse in Egypt, would go ahead and sustain everybody with food. This is how his sefer is going to go ahead and sustain everybody's soul. V'otam sheni kizeh chalki mikol amali. This is his amelus. This is his magnum opus. V'hu beiti, and it is his house. V'olam hazeh v'olam haba. And since he is Rav Yosef Karo, he names it the Beit Yosef. Phenomenal work, the Beit Yosef. But he doesn't end with the Beit Yosef. 20 years later or so, he goes ahead and he writes a companion book called the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch. Now, why did he write the Shulchan Aruch? Did he not already achieve everything that he wanted to in the Beit Yosef? And now here we get a lot very controversial. If I bring this up in any Beit Midrash, fists start fighting. He writes in his Hakdama to the Shulchan Aruch, Ra'iti b'libi, Right, ani b'libi ki tov lelakod shoshanei svari v'marav v'derech tzara v'loshan tzach kolel yafeh v'naim. He wants to go ahead and he wants to write a condensed summarization, bullet points of basically the Beit Yosef. The Beit Yosef is great, but you want to learn, you know, you can read 10 pages and then in the Shulchan Aruch it's just one liner, right? This is what it is. Why did he do this? Leman tiyeh Torah Hashem tamima. So that the Torah should be fluent in your mouth, so you shouldn't even have the hesitation on what the end of it is. You ask a Talmud Chacham what Halacha is. Lo yigam game ba ela yomar lechachma achoti at kishem shebaru lo shachoto asuro lo kach yabaru lo shekol din sheyishal lo halacha lemase. Interesting analogy he gives. Just like anybody asks any halacha, He'll know, just like he knows his sister is prohibited to him in relations. He'll know that the halacha is kach and kach. No hesitation. And here's the most amazing thing that people don't know. He says, I want to divide the Shulchan Aruch into 30 sections. Why? So that you can learn every day. This is the first daf yomi. So you can learn every day a portion of the Shulchan Aruch, and every month you're doing a complete chazara on the Shulchan Aruch. Now this is absurd. This is insane. I wrote here, this is my own writing. There are 1,685 simanim in the Shulchan Aruch. All right, you divide that up, you have 57 simanim a day. 57 simanim a day. 57 simanim. Even if now you have to remember the Shulchan Aruch, the Rav Yosef Karo, he's not saying, you know, you should just read it, you know, just like read it. He's saying you should read it as review, meaning when you sit down to read the Shulchan Aruch and you're doing this review every 30 days, as you're reading the pieces in the Shulchan Aruch, it's supposed to remind you of every single thing that you read in the Beit Yosef. You read this one line in the Shulchan Aruch, you're supposed to close your eyes for a second and think, oh yes, there's that Gemara in Avodah Zarah, and there's the Rashi, and there's the Rambam, and then there's the riff, and then there was that machloket, and then in the end, we get to all that. On every single siman, you're supposed to do that every month. That's crazy. I didn't appreciate this until about 2 years ago. I have to say it. I tell you, 2 years ago, what happened 2 years ago? Rabbi Kellen mentioned I studied many years in Eretz Chemda, and eventually I got Rav Ir Smicha. Now, the last stage of Rav Ir Smicha, you take a number of written tests, which you study for, you know what topic you're studying for, and you're hard at that for months and then. But the last one is an oral exam that you have to take in front of a committee of rabbis in Israel. Now, the thing is that you don't know, it's not like a date, you don't know when it's going to be, it just, they call you up and they say, okay, come in next Tuesday. And it could be a year from now, it could be 2 years from now, and they call you. You have no idea. It's Israel. It's unorganized. That's just the way that they go. So they called me, and they said, it was 2 years ago, they called me, said, come in next Tuesday. I said, what do you mean? I'm in Toronto. I can't come in next Tuesday. They're like, okay, then don't come in next Tuesday, but I don't know when your next chance is going to be. So I said, dropped everything. I said, okay, I got to come in next Tuesday. Now, how do you prepare for a test like this when they can basically ask you anything that you've learned, you know, in all of Shulchan Aruch? What are you supposed to do? You have no idea what they're going to test you on. So I did exactly what Rav Yosef Karo said. I used the Shulchan Aruch as a review book. And I sat there, and I don't know if I got to 57 simanim in a day. It is extremely hard to reach that number. But you just start reading the Shulchan Aruch and doing chazara in your head of everything that you learned on that siman. It's extremely exhausting. But this is what Rabbi Yosef Karo thought that everyone should do. Finish the Shulchan Aruch as a review. This isn't your main learning. This is as a review every single month. That was his first goal with the Shulchan Aruch. Nimshem Chodesh Hu Chozer Talmudo. He goes over on everything that he learned, right? Review. This is like, you know, on your way to the cafeteria between classes, you'll just review on like everything, right? 57 simanim. Okay. Vizot od, another reason. Hatamidim aktanim, even the little kids who aren't sitting down and learning Gemara and the Beit Yosef and all the Rishonim, but they're going to do the Shulchan Aruch, and it's going to be in their mouths so clear, right? Girsa di yinkunta misudor nepiem. It's going to just be so clear. They'll know it by heart like a lullaby. And so when they're older, they'll know the bottom lines and they'll match it to the halacha that they know. The Karati Shem Sefer Zat Shulchan Aruch. This is, he calls it the Shulchan Aruch. Why? Well, even before this line. Now, why do I say this is a debate? Because it's, there. Even in the Achronim, there's a debate whether the Shulchan Aruch was written as an independent Sefer of halacha or as just a companion to the Beit Yosef, and he never in a million years expected anybody to just open up the Shulchan Aruch in their adult years and paskin straight from that. And that machlok is not just academic; it will impact on how you read certain things within the Shulchan Aruch. I have a certain opinion on it. I think I made it clear what it is, but if not, for another time. Now, here's an interesting thing. He says, "B'krati Shem Sefer Zeh Shulchan Aruch." Why does he call it the Shulchan Aruch, the set table? Ki bo yimtza ha'aga kol minei mita'amim arukim b'chol mishmorim sedurim burim. Because you're going to find a set table with all of these delights on it, all the food is set there. You just come to the table and you go ahead and take what you want to eat. Why is this interesting? Where does this language of Shulchan Aruch come from? This analogy to a Shulchan Aruch? This brings us to the beginning. And this has to do with the Parshas Mishpatim. It's the Mechilta. The Mechilta says like this. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe. Moshe and HaKadosh Baruch Hu are having a little discussion. Lo tala al datcha. Hashem says to Moshe, don't even think about it, Moshe. I know what you're thinking. Don't do this. You're going to say what? Eshne lehem aperek v'halacha shtayim v'shalosh. I'll teach them something two or three times. I'll just teach them two or three times. Ad sh'teh sedurah mepiyem. They'll understand what to do. They'll get the main psak at the end of it. Ve'inu matreach atzmi la'vinam ta'ameh ha'davar u'perusham. But I'm not going to go ahead and explain it. I'm not going to get into details. I'm not going to get bogged down on all the intricates that are behind the din. They'll know the bottom line. Two or three times, they got it. Good, move on to the next one. Hashem says, Moshe, don't do that. L'kach ne'emar. That's why I say in this week's parasha, asher tasim lifneihem, you should place it before them. What does that mean? Kishulchan aruch u'muchan l'chol lifnei adam. It should be in front of them, ready for them to eat. Right? They should have all of the reasoning behind all of the dinim. Similarly, the Gemara in Erevin in source number 2 says similar. Minayin shechayv l'arot lo panim. How do you know you're supposed to go ahead everything should be clear and set before them. It should be logical in fashion. It should be all clear to be in front of them. So why is that ironic? Because according to the Mechilta, what does it mean, the language of Shulchan Aruch? It should be set with, you should understand everything from it. All of the reasons, everything that went into the psak, all of it. The Rav Yosef Karo, he says, Shulchan Aruch, it should be right there in front of you. Right? Open up the Shulchan Aruch. There's no reasons, no ta'amim. It just tells you what the halacha is. So the only explanation I can have for this discrepancy is that they must have had different eating styles. I don't know. I think Rav Yosef, you know, in the Chilta had like was like a real like four course meal with like five knives and forks and soup and dessert and jello in between. And Rav Yosef Karo was like a fast food smorgasbord type thing. That's how they viewed Shulchan Aruch. Okay. All right, that's the Rambam, and that is Rav Yosef Karo. Similar ideas, similar, not exactly the same, that we need to codify this idea of codification. We need to codify halacha, that there should be one Torah for Am Yisrael. It should be clear. We don't need machloket. I mean, you need the bottom line. This is what to do. We don't have time now to open up every single sugya and to go on and have rayos back and forth. Now, the first opposition to the Shulchan Aruch isn't really an opposition so much. It's the Ramah. So Rav Moshe Isserles, who lived at the same time of Rav Yosef Karo, he lived in Poland. Now, interestingly, he was writing something exactly like Rav Yosef Karo. Rav Yosef Karo just beat him to it. He published it beforehand, and you can imagine your life work, and like you're about to like go ahead and you're like you finish it like ah, and then someone comes running in and like, hey, did you see this new book that I just got at like Barnes and Nobles? And you're like, are you kidding me? Like I just 20 years. Like why didn't we have like Google and I could have found out that he was working on this? So Rav Moshe Isserles, instead of deciding to go ahead and print the work that he was working on, he says, you know what? I got a better idea. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to write a commentary on the Beit Yosef. And I'm going to write a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. Right? He calls it the Dorchei Moshe on the Beit Yosef and the Mapa for the Shulchan Aruch. Actually, he calls it the Mapa. He calls it the tablecloth, right? Nobody calls it the Mapa. They call it the Ramah. But he was trying to be like, you know, all linguistic and poetic, but it didn't catch on. But let's see what he's right, because it's interesting what he writes and what he actually does in the Shulchan Aruch. So the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles writes like this in his Hakdama, his introduction. We should have a series just on introductions. I mean, they're just, once upon a time, people wrote introductions. They were important. They told you history. They told you intent of writing the books. Now people write introductions. It's just, you know, thank yous. Anyways, the Rama writes like this. Bati Acharav, I'm now coming after the Shulchan Aruch. Lefros mapa al Shulchan Aruch. He set the table. Let me put the tablecloth on. Shechaver alem kol pri magadim. He gave all these delights and treats. Mitamim asher yaheva adam. That everybody loves. Beautiful job he did. Below zeh haShulchan asher hu arach lefnei Hashem. Lo natnu adayin lefnei adam asher b'niyot elu. But the problem is his book, his table, it's not the treats that he put there. There aren't for our taste. There aren't for our palate up here in Ashkenaz. Asher rubo minhagim donut elu nohagim kivate. We don't really hold like any most of the stuff that he says. What the Rambam and the Rif and the Rush? You think that they have control of what goes in Ashkenaz? We got the Chumash Hadesh, the Gos Ashri, we got Tosfot, Rashi, we got all these other Ashkenazim. Okay, as he says, Alkein ra'iti l'chtov dat achronim, therefore I decided I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to add on the opinion of the Ashkenazim on the side. Kedei lo'orel hartamidim b'chol makom sheyidu sheyesh machloket b'dvarav. I'm just going to make a little commentary so you should know not everybody holds this way. There are other opinions. Umish yesh lo chech litom. And if anybody has a good palate, you can go ahead and you can taste which is the right opinion. I want to be intellectually honest, says the Ramah. I'm gonna lay it all out for you. That's what the Ramah says he's gonna do, but he doesn't actually do that. He kind of tells you, he wants you to think that the halacha is like the Ashkenazim, and he does this often. The Mechaber, the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo will write something which is possibly a little enigmatic. You know, it can be looked at, read in two different ways. And he was, Rav Yosef Karo was assuming you would know how to read it because you read the Beit Yosef. And the Ramah will go ahead and add on a few words, which totally is not like, oh, and you should know there's another opinion which says something totally different. He'll add on a few words. He'll say, and by the way, what this means is X, Y, and Z. Meaning he'll re-explain the Shulchan Aruch to go ahead and sometimes be like the opinions of the Ashkenazim. Not always, but he does it enough that there's actually one of the Nosei Kelim, I think it was the Taz. Taz? One of them goes ahead and he wants you to make it clear. He writes, I want to make it clear that the Shulchan Aruch does not say like the Ramah makes him say, right? They hold, there's a big machloka going on. Don't think that they hold the same thing. It's just that the Ramo went ahead and he wrote it in a way, so you should think that the Shulchan Aruch wrote exactly like that. But the Ramo did this, and this is a rabbinic joke. He says, because Zed Dorko Shel Moshe, this is the way of Moshe. It's a funny joke because his previous book is called The Darkei Moshe. Okay, enough of rabbinic humor. Okay, that's a very long intro into what happened to the codification of Halacha. There was a huge opposition to what was happening here, especially in Poland, and especially in the Beit Midrash of the Ramah. Right? The Ramah had contemporaries who were all in the same Beit Midrash. The three that main opponents to the codification in general, was the Marshal. Right, we have the Marshal, we have the Maharal, and the Maharal's brother. Rav Chaim ben Bezalel. Okay, all three of them, they all learned in the same Beit Midrash. They were all students of the same Rebbe, you know, sharing notes with each other and whatnot. And they were vehemently against codification in general. And the interesting thing is why. So I didn't bring here, but I'll bring the first two. Well, I'll bring the main points of the brother of the Maharal, of Rav Chaim ben Bezalel, which are basically pragmatic issues. They're pragmatic issues, and they're as such. Like, let's say you have somebody who opens up the Shulchan Aruch, and all of a sudden they're looking at it, but the guy's not the biggest Talmud Chacham, and he's looking at it. He knows a little learning. He can read what's going on, and he goes out and he paskins halacha from the Shulchan Aruch. He paskins halacha from the Shulchan Aruch, but he doesn't really understand the sugya, so he's going to make a mistake. He's going to make a mistake. And this happens. This happens nowadays. I had somebody ask me a question once, ask me a halacha question, and I told them what my answer was, and they said, oh, but I spoke to this other rabbi, and he told me this, and he actually quoted for me this line, and he quoted me a certain line in the Shulchan Aruch. I said, yeah, I know that line. And it's talking about a totally different halacha. Meaning, even Talmid Chacham, even rabbis, you know, they make a mistake if you don't understand the full extent of the sugya. And the problem of making a book of law, of codified law, is that people will just go ahead and they'll rely on that, and they won't go to the sugya. They won't understand things to its depth. So besides people making a mistake, it's also going to lead to now a secondary mistake. People will stop learning Bi'in. They'll stop learning in depth, because they'll say, well, what do I need to? I got a book of codified law. It tells me everything I need to do. Other issues are that we think that all communities develop the same. All halacha was the same in every community. Every community has different customs and different halachas that develop. So the Shulchan Aruch says that this is how things are in Sfarim. That's how everyone did, right? In Poland, you think all of the communities did exactly like the Ramah said? It's not true at all. And not only that, it confines it will detract from what the current practices are. Right? You see this in, I heard this from Rav Schachter. Rav Schachter once was talking about how the Mishnah Brura became had so much teeth, because when Rav Schachter says when he was growing up, nobody learned the Mishnah Brura. You learned the Mavush, you learned the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. You didn't learn the Mishnah Brura. But how did the Mishnah Brura have so much teeth, especially in North America? Because the Talmidim of the Chavetz Chaim came and they started to go ahead and teach his Torah and teach his Pesachim. But Rav Schachter, I have to take Rav Shachar's word on this, but he says, even in Radin, they didn't paskin like the Mishnah Brura. The Mishnah Brura writes all these different halachos, and you ask people in Radin, they're like, nobody does that, right? So, but now the Mishnah Brura writes it, and it becomes the halacha in North America, because it's Talmidim, come and they make it the halacha. And some places it'll overtake what the current custom is. So another claim against codification is that, what do you think, there's one Torah for everybody? There isn't one Torah for everybody. There are different communities. The Torah has evolved in different societies. Okay. All of those are pragmatic. We could deal with those. Those are little, you know, technical issues that we can get over. You know, we can create a better codified book which deals with them. But I want to go to something more essential, a more essential machloka. But even before that, I just want to, it's something interesting that the Maharal writes. The Maharal writes near here. I'll read it in English quickly. Nowadays, if people would decide halacha from the Mishnah, that would be enough, right? Let's go back to the Mishnah, because the Mishnah is at least at the beginning of the Talmud. But instead, they established halacha from collections of rulings meant for practical guidance, right? They're jumping to all these shulchan aruch, so to speak, which were made to issue rulings, but not to learn from. This is even further evil. The Rishonim, such as the Rambam and the Torah Blessed Memory, even though they also wrote their rulings without explanation, they just intended to provide practical rules based on what emerged from Talmud. However, for one to establish halacha from it without knowing where the law emerged from, as a law without reason, that never entered their minds. If the authors had known that their works would cause people to leave the Talmud and would determine halacha from their works, they would never have authored them. For it is better and more proper, this is a crazy statement that he makes, to establish halacha from the Talmud, even if one worries that he will not follow the true path and decide truthfully, then his decision should be accurate. Right? And I saw actually a Chuvas of a Gaonim, someone showed me last week, where he says, better to rule from the Talmud and make a mistake than just rule from one of the Chuvas of the Gaonim and absolutely know what you're talking about and follow his ruling, even if it's correct. In any case, a wise man has only what his intellect gives him and understands from the Talmud, and if his wisdom and understanding lead him astray, still is beloved to God. Now, but the Maharal's basic point here is that these books were never meant to be just a psak. It's supposed to be at the end of your limud, you can go ahead and use them to go ahead and kind of summarize or justify the original psak. I'm sorry, I against the Maharal, but that was not the intent of the Rambam. You know, maybe you can, Rav Yosef Karo, I'll give it to you. But the Rambam is clear as day. The Rambam dissolved the Gemara. He said, you don't even need it. Like, open my book, and here is the halacha. If you would ask the Rambam, do you want me to first learn the Gemara and then come to you? He'd say, no, don't waste your time. Here it is. Just open my book. Here's the halacha. Why waste your time learning the Gemara? So, hard to make sense of how to justify the moral statement there. Anyways, that's it was an interesting point. Rabbi Kalman, how much time do we have? Where?
Officially, you have 7 minutes.
Unofficially?
How much do you need?
Oh, okay, I understand.
Oh, you know what? Maybe summarize some of the sources so you can get to the end.
Okay.
Gershom Shalom. I like a shir that has the Rambam and Gershom Shalom in the same shir, you know?
Oh, so. Okay, okay. We won't leave, So the Yom Shel Shlomo, or Shlomo Luria, I think makes the most essential argument against codification. It's not pragmatic. It's not a technical issue. Oh, it's going to cause this. He says, I don't care what Pitrono, what solutions you have to all the issues my companions raised against codification. Under no circumstance should there ever be any book of codification of Jewish law. It's anti-halachic. It's anti-halachic. It's anti-Judaism. Judaism is not a book of codified law. Okay, I'm gonna say outside, right? He says, first of all, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who do you think you are? You think that you're going to go ahead and write a book that like is going to end all machloket? You don't think the Rambam tried this? Did it work? It didn't work. There was just more machloket. And he goes as far as to say, look what Rabbi Yehuda, this is crazy because I've never seen anybody attack Rabbi Yehuda Nasi on this. Look what Rabbi Yehuda Nasi tried to do. He tried to write down the oral law so that it shouldn't splinter off. So we shouldn't forget it. And what happened? Is the mission a success? I mean, until I read this, I would have thought, yeah, absolutely, the mission is a success. Well, of course, the Mishnah saved Judaism. But he says it's a disaster. Because you know what happened from the Mishnah? The Talmud. We've got Gemara. And we got more arguing and more fighting and all this. And he didn't do anything. The codification doesn't work. And this comes to the original point. Oral law is meant to stay oral. It's not supposed to be written down. The Mishnah was not supposed to be written down. Maybe it had to, and we have to bite the bullet on that one, and deal with the ramifications of it. But it wasn't supposed to. We have to talk about why it wasn't supposed to. And just like an oral law wasn't supposed to be written down, halacha is not supposed to be codified. It's just not, under no circumstance. Okay, he's got some sharp words. We're gonna leave that. What's interesting is what he writes at the beginning. He writes this in the Hesagdama to Baba Kama. He writes this in the Hesagdama to Chulin, more or less the same with minor differences. He writes like this. He says, where we're going to jump in. He says, you know, Shlomo HaMelech says, he was criticizing people of the times, that people are writing svarim in kates and everybody's writing their own things, and it's awful. Right? So who are you, the Rambam, to go ahead and nowadays it's just worse. Right? You should be surprised by all this machloket that's going on here. Why? If everything is done l'shem shemayim with good intent, that's how it's supposed to be. I have to say this. His other issue is even if you want to go ahead and decide codified lacha, what are you playing, Russian roulette? Like, we're just going to roll a die, and like if it lands on the Rambam, then that's the halacha? He says, I have to read the end, because it's, he says at the end here, I don't care who said what. I don't care what Rishon you're going to say. You need to go back to the Talmud. Halacha needs to be decided. Every halacha needs to be reevaluated and decided from the Gemara. I won't go ahead and believe any mechaber. I don't care who says it. Even if he's the greatest man in the world, we go back to the Gemara. And proofs, logical proofs from the Gemara. Now, why is this? Why? The Maharshal brings, it's a little bit mystic in a sense. He doesn't say it in a mystical sense. If you just read it, you're like, oh, that's nice, that's poetic. But he's going into mysticism here. And he's saying, we'll go straight to Gershom Shalom. Okay? Gershom Shalom is an interesting person. I could get Torah in Motion, I can mention him, but in other places I might not be allowed to. But I'm a fan of a lot of the stuff that he writes. I think he did he opened up Jewish mysticism. He took it to an academic level, and his stuff is really beautiful. That aside, so he says like this, talking about the nature of revelation itself. Revelation is revelation of the names of Hashem, which are perhaps the different modes of his active being, whatever that means. Okay, the creative force is thus concentrated in the names of God, which is the essential word that God sends forth from himself, is far greater than any human expression, than any creaturely word can grasp. It is never exhausting by finite human word. What happened at Revelation is basically the infinite went ahead and expressed itself in the finite, which is an impossible task. Thus the Torah is texture, an ariga, fashioned out of the names of God. Each name of God is an analogy, is an expression of God, different expressions of God. As the early Spanish Kabbalist is referring to Meir Ibn Gabay, who was the first one to really set forth a comprehensive doctrine of Jewish mysticism, out of the great absolute name of God, which is the final signature of all things, he's referring to the Ramban here. It constitutes a mysterious whole whose primary purpose is not to transmit a specific sense to mean something. Revelation is not to give you, this is the halacha, this is a pasuk, this is a word. Absolutely not. Rather, to express the force of divinity itself, which is concentrated in this name. It'll be clear. Thus, the very words that we read in the written Torah and that constitutes the audible word of God and communicate a comprehensible message are in reality meditations through which the absolute word, incomprehensible to us, is offered. The absolute word is originally communicated in its limitless fullness, but, and that is the key point, this communication is incomprehensible. You can't take it and fit it into a box. It doesn't fit into words. It doesn't fit into one way of looking at things. It's not a communication which provides comprehension, being basically nothing but the expression of essence. It becomes a comprehensible communication only when it is mediated. It is this thesis that the word of God carries infinite meaning, however it may be defined. Even that which has already become a sign in the strict sense, and it is already a mediated word, retains the character of the absolute. But if there is such a thing as God's word, it must, of course, be totally different from human word. It's an analogy. When we talk about God spoke, God gave these words, God said something, God doesn't speak. That's not how the infinite expresses itself in the finite. It is far-reaching, all-embracing, and, unlike a human word, cannot be applied to a specific context of meaning. In other words, God's word is infinitely interpretable Indeed, it is the object of interpretation par excellence. In every word, there now shines an infinite multitude of lights. We now face the problem of tradition. Now he gets to the point. As it has presented itself to the Kabbalist. If the conception of revelation is absolute and meaning-giving, but in itself meaningless is correct, then it must also be true that revelation will come to unfold an infinite meaning, which cannot be confined to the unique event of a revelation. Namely, revelation, the infinite expression of God in this world, is not something that can happen all at once. It's something that unfolds throughout history, throughout different circumstances, throughout different individuals. Only in its constant relationship to history, the arena in which tradition unfolds. Theologians have described the word of God as absolute concrete. But the absolute concrete at the same time, the simply unfillable, is that which no way can be put into practice. The Kabbalist idea of tradition is founded upon the data. Okay, here. Tradition undergoes changes with the times. New facets of its meaning shine forth and lighting its way. Tradition, according to its mystical sense, is oral Torah, precisely because every stabilization in the text would hinder and destroy the infinite meaning, moving and constantly progressing and unfolding elements with it, which would otherwise become putrefied. The writing down and codification of the oral law, undertaken in order to save it from being forgotten, was therefore as much a pernicious act demanded by the historical circumstances of exile. It was profoundly problematic for the living growth and continuance of the tradition in its original sense. Meaning, if you imagine you had like a waterfall, right? And this is oral law. This is the revelation coming. And you say, wow, it's just moving. It's going. So what do? You take a picture of it and you freeze frame it. This is a freeze frame of oral law. That's not revelation. That's not halacha. That's one freeze frame of halacha. But it's ever flowing. And it could be expressed in many different ways. And that's what contradiction is. That's what machloket is. And that's why the Maharshal is saying you need to go back to the Talmud to go ahead and find the halacha. Because the way the Talmud, it wasn't like poorly edited. Like students ask, why are we learning the Gemara? Let's just learn, bottom line halacha. Give me the Rambam. Give me the Shulchan Aruch. Halavai, they should be saying that. Why are we learning Gemara? Okay, right? It's all roundabout. There's machloket. There's fighting. The Maharshal is saying Sholem is saying that's the point. Like it was intended to be that way, so that you should get into the flow of the water. You don't want a freeze frame, and every posek has to go to his situation. Go back into the sea of Talmud and see how the water, how the waves are going to ride for that specific case. There cannot be a codification of halacha because halacha is ever evolving. It's an expression of the infinite in the finite. And when you codify it, you've killed it. You've lost it. The Rambam didn't view it that way, right? The Shulchan Aruch didn't view it that way. Machloket is bad. Let's codify things. Let's make it one. Right? It's a historical accident that we broke it up to things. But that's not how the mystics viewed it. And that's the essential claim against any type of codification. And by the way, that's what makes our gut feeling of Judaism is rigid. It's locking me into place, right? If you want a real controversial article, you can go online and read Nathan Cardoza's article on this. I think he pushed the limit a little too far, but he basically makes the same exact point, just a little more extreme. The halacha was not supposed to be rigid. It was supposed to be ever flowing and adaptive to all of different cases. You can't codify it. It just doesn't work. Where are we now? Let's see, one more minute and I'm done with that. Where are we now? Did it work? Did Rav Yosef Karo's, did it work? Shulchan Aruch was the final posek acharon, das acharon. So it didn't work. I mean, to a certain extent, it was a reset. Right, and now it became a new platform in which we can argue what the halacha is, but it was just a reset. Right, it's like these great giants, Rav Yehuda HaNasi, Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam. They have there's this beast called revelation, called halacha, and they're trying to tame it. They're trying to get a new. They're trying to go ahead and get a leash around it, and saying I have it. And I think what history has showed us is that it's untamable. It's ever flowing and And, you know, and we'll see what happens when we have the Sanhedrin and we're outside of this this halachic paralysis. Okay, I'm past my time, so I
will. Bye-bye. Thank you. I know it's late, and I don't know if we have really time, but I would love to discuss the Dora V's introduction with you. I assume you're familiar with it, which says many of these same points in a very Zionistic sense, that now that we've returned to Zion, the Dora V', I mentioned him in some of my shurim in the summer, the great-grandson of the Chatam Sofer, the first great, oldest great-grandson, therefore he named his book Dora V' as a Sefer on Chulin, and he wrote a phenomenal introduction to the history of the Oral Law. He was from Hungary, and there were not so many Zionists in Hungary. They basically threw him out of Mattersdorf and Klausenberg, and he came to Israel in 1923, and he was a big Zionist, and he writes how the law, it's bad that we have a Gemara, kind of. I mean, he doesn't say that exactly like that, but written law codification is really bad, and we had no choice. Codification is exile, and when we come, and redemption is when we don't have codification, when we have a flowing halakha to be flexible, deal with the ever situation. And now that we're coming back to Israel, he's writing this in, I don't know exactly when, but he died in 1924. So I already comment on it, but Rabbi, you want to spend a minute commenting on the Dora V'? I'm sorry if I did it for you.
No, I agree. I agree in a certain sense of, I mean, I think the Am Yisrael is in a sense, Am Yisrael is being splintered in two different ways, right? There are, you know, you can go to certain bookstores and you can find a 700 page volume on the mitzvah of Tefillat Kelim. Right. And I'm being a little, you know, cynical about it. And it's an important book. I use those books. I use them. They're very important. But we've become so codified that, like, you can't move, you know?
That's basically Chaim Soloveitchik's article in Rupture and Reconstruction. He makes the same page. And I think he quotes, and it is a real book, a 600-page book on Spirit of Omer. It says, in the Shulchan Aruch, Spirit of Omer is one sentence. And they have today, Baruch Hashem, they published 600 pages for Spirit of Omer. So,
that's on the one side. On the other extreme, we have, you know, on the edge, you have Nathan Cardoza saying, "Let's just go back to the Gemara and everybody do whatever they want." You know,
like, he says, "Paskin like Beit Shammai if you want."
Make it a free for all. So those are two extremes within what I'm going to consider orthodoxy. I'm putting both of those in orthodoxy. I don't know where history is going to go, but it's, we are definitely going in those different directions, and the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, because that's the safest place to be.
Orthodoxy is also an exile invention, invented in the 1800s, but that's for another shear. But that's for sure an exile, you know, but anyways. Okay, did anybody have any questions? I didn't see so many questions in the chat box, so that's why I figured I would ask up anybody if any comments. Really, the history, there's a lot there. There's a lot, really. Thank you for this sort of brief overview on Parshat Mishpatim, the Parsha par excellence of Halakha. This is where Halakha begins. I assume that's the connection to the Parsha. And besides the opening, the line in the Mechilta, Asher Tasim Lifneihem, that it's got to be, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu got to explain everything.
Well, and a part of it's also, for those who do Shnai Mikra, they get a little frustrated and they get to Mishpatim, because, like, the Parsha is not that long, but Rashi, like, he kills you. He's like, he's got to bring in every Gemara and all of Baba Kama and Baba Metzia, and you're like, really? So if we say that it shouldn't be codified and get rid of the Gemara, we could just do Shnai Mikra with, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions? Otherwise, we'll wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Thank you for staying.